Tot 11 uur de boeddhistische omroep met De Middenweg. Presentatie Ton Maas.
Goedenavond. Noah Levine is de auteur van boeken als Dharma Punks en Against the Stream. Ook is hij oprichter van de Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society, met een centrum in Los Angeles en meer dan 20 aangesloten afdelingen in Noord-Amerika. Op 26 mei gaf Levine een lezing in Amsterdam. Menno Bijleveld sprak met hem over de wisselwerking tussen punk en boeddhisme, de desastreuze gevolgen van verslaving en het transformerend effect van meditatie in zijn leven.
So I thought that maybe a nice topic to start with and to talk about is this perspective that the Buddhist path, perhaps all genuinely transformative spiritual practices, are an act of rebellion, or as the Buddha put it, against the stream. And if you're familiar with this term, the Pali, the Buddhist word, was patiso tagami, the ancient Pali word. And it comes in the history of Buddhism and in the teachings of the Buddha just after his awakening. So what we think we know, Buddhism is so mythologized at this point that I more and more question what I think I know about the Buddha, and kind of not so concrete. It used to be like, no, this is exactly what the Buddha's life was like. For instance, we've all heard that the Buddha was a prince, right? And he had palaces in the summer and the winter, and he rejected all of that and went off and sought enlightenment, rejected his comfortable palace life. This is the story, right, that we've heard. You heard that? So, very interesting that now modern science and archaeologists have been looking for the ruins of the palaces in the area. And, you know, you can find ruins 2,500 years old. They can't find any palaces in the town where the Buddha definitely did grow up. So it's feeling more and more like, okay, this was another religious exaggeration. This was more like we always get in religion, these sort of, and he walked on water, exaggerations, rather than he was a really kind person. No, he did magic.
But the water has been found.
The water has definitely been found. Footprints, yes. And I think that that's important for people who are interested in Buddhism or any religion, to kind of be able to be critical of it and to be able to say, okay, some of this is definitely true and some of this is myth, folklore, and religion exaggeration. California, Uber Alice, California, Uber Alice, California, Uber Alice.
Noah, about your approach to the Dharma, you wrote a book called Dharma Punks, and if I'm well, you call yourself a Dharma Punk. What does it mean to be a Dharma Punk?
I don't necessarily have a real kind of clear definition for it. For me, and of course it's inspired by Jack Kerouac and the beatniks that called themselves the Dharma Bums. And as I got more and more involved in Buddhism, coming from a punk culture and subculture, it made more and more sense to me to have this kind of influence of integrating my punk ethic with my Dharma ethic. The punk ethic is rebellion, is rejecting the status quo societal norms, which are clearly confused and are causing suffering. Also, the Dharma ethic is based on dissatisfaction with the status quo and ending suffering. So in that way, I think that the Dharma and punk are very much aligned, at least in the first noble truth. The first noble truth is acknowledging suffering. I believe that that's what the punks are doing. Now, the second noble truth in the Dharma is acknowledging the cause of suffering, and then the third, ending suffering. I'm not sure that so many of the punks take it that far. You know, it's quite easy to get stuck in just critiquing the problem and never getting all the way around to the solution. So that's where kind of integrating Dharma punk for me has been, yes, I'm very well aware of the problem and I'm well involved in the solution as well.
You still feel related to punk?
Yeah, in general, I feel that it is my culture. You know, on one level, it's the music and fashion and that I've just grown up with and have always related to. But I feel like it's the voice of a fierce wisdom in this world, one of the voices of fierce wisdom in this world, that's really talking about the world as it is and not the fantasy of how it is, but really like clearly and critiquing and seeing what's happening in this world. So I appreciate that very much. Of course, there can be a real angry edge to punk, but I also feel that angry edge inside of myself, and so I relate to it. Some would maybe ask, well, is it fueling anger? And maybe the answer sometimes is yes, that it's fueling anger. I more take the perspective that it's a healthy outlet for the kind of anger at injustice, if also balanced with solution and not just staying with anger, if balanced with compassion.
Do you or did you relate to a specific form of punk?
Well, I had a bit of an eclectic punk. You know, punk is such a kind of umbrella term. Earliest influences were the kind of original English punk, Sex Pistols, Damned, The Clash. Later, had much more influence by the American punk movement, Southern California, Black Flag, Circle Jerks. Some of the New York hardcore, also much of an influence, Agnostic Front, and of course the Ramones as the sort of foundation maybe for all of it, and Dead Kennedys, the San Francisco political punks with Dead Kennedys and Crucifix, and I mean there's just been so many different incarnations of punk and different perspectives. You know, when I was younger and I was just angry, I wasn't so interested in the political punk, you know, and the English bands like Crass and Discharge, or, you know, I wasn't so influenced by. But now, later, I hear the great wisdom in what we would call peace punks, political punks, and I more and more relate to it now.
But what is punk about these days, you think?
Well, I imagine that it's the same as it has always been, that it's a critical analysis of life, and that it is the voice of angst and rebellion against ignorance in human civilization, in the world on some level. Of course, it has changed a lot as it has become more and more popularized and, you know, kind of become mainstream, accepted. And so there are forms of punk that have been very watered down. But I think that there's still a very strong underground punk movement, you know, of kind of just playing in garages and basements, and that's still quite alive and well.
And are you still connected to this scene?
On some level, I'm still connected. You know, being a sort of family person, I don't get out to shows the way that I used to. But it's still the music that I listen to. And many of my close friends have been successful in the kind of punk music scene. So if their bands are playing, maybe I'll go see them. You know, I'll still make an effort to get out to see bands like Motorhead or Bad Brains or some of the old bands. But most of the old bands I've seen so many times that when they come around, I don't even go anymore. But there's a few that if I have the chance, I'll always go see Motorhead when I get the chance. I'll always go see Bad Brains when I have the chance. And you know, so there's a few bands that I will still go see.
And do you still practice pogoing and stage diving and headbanging and all that?
Depending on my mood, certainly I, you know, will sometimes, and then but I don't feel as much necessity to do it as I did when I was younger, and I was pent up with so much rage that slam dancing was a outlet for it. Now, I kind of, if I feel energized and feel like jumping off of the stage, or I will, but it's not a necessity for me. Also, I'm getting old, so it hurts more to, you know, be slam dancing than it used to.
Is there still a punk lyric you relate to strongly?
I don't know that I have one right now when I'm sitting here, but I was just, as you asked the question, reflecting on how a few years ago I was sitting a 3-month silent meditation retreat. And for what seemed like many days, and perhaps even a couple of weeks, I had this Black Flag lyric stuck in my head while I was meditating, and it said, I'm about to have a nervous breakdown. My head really hurts. If I don't get out of here, I'm going to go berserk. And there was this sort of struggle on retreat of being in silence for months where this kind of lyric was just kind of going through as an old old message. I'm about to have a nervous breakdown. My head really hurts. If I don't find a way out of here, I'm going to go berserk. I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Yeah, just kind of popped up. And then also often when you're on retreat, your life starts to kind of play itself out in your mind. And there was a Social Distortion song called Story of My Life. And so then some of those lyrics would come kind of as I was watching my mind think about my childhood and my life. And the story of my life would play itself out in my head some. And so the against the stream ethic of the Buddha, I think, is much more than just meditation. It's also a social, political call to action. So the Buddha wakes up and he says, against the stream. That's how I got here. Let me formulate it. Four noble truths. First of all, acknowledge suffering in your life. And not only acknowledge it, but embrace it. Know it fully. All of the ways that you're dissatisfied. Now, most of us don't want to do that. I don't want to look at how come I'm... I want to ignore that. I don't want to look at my dissatisfaction. First task, he says, suffering can be known. Suffering has been fully known. The cause of suffering, craving, greed, attachment, can be relinquished, has been relinquished, released. Nibbana, attained. Freedom from getting burned by greed, hatred, and delusion. The Eightfold Path as the prescription, the medicine for our suffering. But he doesn't stop there. He says, okay, here's your personal, here's your medicine. Now go take it. And he spends his whole life teaching as an advisor to politicians, to the kings and warlords of his time, constantly encouraging nonviolence to a violent, war-torn political system that he was involved in, that he was in. Constantly telling the kings, the warlords, violence does not solve your problems. In a violent conflict, there are always two losers, the winner and the loser. Your karma does not escape you.
Do people always need to suffer in order to meet the Dharma?
What I think that the answer is yes, on some level or another, that this first noble truth of the Buddha's Dharma, which is that there is suffering in everyone's life. And so there has to be some level of acknowledgement and acceptance and understanding that there is suffering in order to meet the path to Dharma, to awakening and to ending suffering. It doesn't have to be as extreme, perhaps, as it was in my life. Sometimes it's simple enough for people to just feel some stress and to feel some desire to be free from stress, and that is what leads to their Dharma practice. It doesn't have to be the kind of addiction that I experienced, but some level of dissatisfaction seems necessary. If you're already happy and completely satisfied with your life, you probably won't be motivated to meditate.
How bad was the situation you were in before you were able to change?
Well, it was sort of progressive from, starting very young, experimenting with smoking marijuana and taking LSD and drinking alcohol, till, in my early teens, by the time I was 14, 15 years old, I was doing cocaine and heroin to the point where I was completely addicted to a daily use of crack cocaine, injecting heroin and drinking alcohol kind of constantly. And that real kind of depth only lasted for about 2 years. There was sort of experimentation, and probably maybe by the time I was 14 or 15, I was addicted. But then I got in so much trouble, and the consequences were so extreme. But by the time I was 17 years old and was completely strung out on cocaine and heroin and alcohol, that I was in jail and got clean and sober and have been in recovery ever since that time. I hear the same old talk, 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 the same old lies. Don't tell me that today, if you know what's good for you, you'll get out of my way, cause I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Hurt on my shoulder.
You are from a family of hippie parents, so you come from a very idealistic background. How could it happen that you ended up in this kind of situation?
Well, I imagine that on one level, the hippie ideals were part of the problem. That my parents' own experimentation with drugs was an influence on me. Their maybe ideas about their children having their own karma and free will in this, that they were maybe a little loose and not enough boundaries with me and with the other children. So I think that was an influence. And on one side of my family, my father and my stepmother are very committed to spiritual ideals, and on the other side, my mother, my birth mother, really struggling with addiction and alcoholism when I was growing up. And so I had the sort of setup for my own addiction, and then also to coming to the Dharma when I was ready.
But eventually you rejected this hippie shit, but finally you took it aboard. What happened?
One of the ways that I've thought about it was that growing up in the punk scene and our parents having been involved in the hippie movement, that there was this rejection completely of everything, their spiritual ideals, their political ideals. But that my own life's experiments, my punk rock rebellion and drug addiction and everything that it led to, had me in the place where I was just felt like I was drowning in this sea of sorrow and addiction and suffering. And so it felt on some level like this lifeboat came along and said, here we can throw you this life preserver. We can throw you this rope and we can save your life. And at the time, it wasn't so important to me whether it was hippies that were saving my life or not. It was just that I was sort of destroying myself and that it seemed that maybe there was a solution here. And, even with all of my adversarial relationship to the hippie culture, I had a strong, loving relationship with my father. And so the fact that he was the one there saying, maybe meditation will help you, that I was able to accept it. I was always in contact with my father. I left home when I was 16, but we stayed in contact, And at some point later in my life, I asked my father, I said, when I was 16 years old, you emancipated me. You let me leave home. And I was already, in all kinds of trouble with the law and drugs and everything. And you knew that pretty much. And I asked him, I said, why did you let me go? Why didn't you, probably you should have sent me to a rehabilitation center or something. And he said that he knew the problems that I was having. And at the time, he felt that if he had kind of sent me away, that then I would run away and he would lose contact with me forever. But that if he let me go with his blessing, that I would stay in contact and that when I was ready to change, he would be able to be there to facilitate the change. And I understand that actually in that case, it was true. Because we stayed in contact, and then when I was ready, he helped me.
So if you look back to his attitude, it was maybe the right attitude.
At the time, it was the right attitude, because everything worked out for me.
Yeah. Was there no other option than starting to do meditation?
I guess at the time I felt like I had exhausted the other options. I had done all of the drugs, and they clearly weren't ending suffering. They were creating more. The crime, the sex, the money, none of it was working. And so it did feel like I was becoming hopeless. And that when I began to meditate, it gave me hope. That possibly this was a tool where I could actually find some contentment. I won't apologize for acting out of line. You see the way I am. You leave any time you die, God. I'll fight me out of line. Turn on my shoulders. Going. The first time I started to meditate, I was in jail, and I had, so much shame and regret for all of the years of crime and addiction that had brought me to that place. So my mind was just filled with this remorse. And then the rest of the time, my mind was filled with this fear and this terror of going to prison for the rest of my life. Had very serious criminal charges at the time. And so when I was given the simple meditation instruction to pay attention to my breath, at first it didn't make much sense. But when I did it, when I directed my awareness to my breathing, it gave me relief from my thinking. Now, I wasn't able to stop the thoughts from coming back in, but even just those moments of feeling the breath rather than being lost in the future, which was awful, or the past, which was awful, was such a powerful revelation. So it was a relief, and it also, I began to understand for the first time in my life that I could choose what I paid attention to. My whole life, I'd just been doing whatever my crazy mind was telling me to do. But as I began to meditate, I realized I could ignore my mind. I could make a decision whether or not to follow those thoughts or whether to remain mindful in the body.
And how was it to do that in prison? I mean, were you sharing a cell with others?
No, at that time I was in a cell by myself. So, I had the privacy to do it. So it was okay. I mean, of course, I was detoxing from drugs and I was, very uncomfortable, but it was still very useful. And it wasn't like I was meditating all day, just trying a little bit. But even just in that trying, I was beginning to see, this might work for me.
What is the power of meditation? That it can transform your life?
Maybe in a simple way, I would say what it is doing is training our hearts and our minds. In Buddhism, we have this word citta, which translates as the heart mind. And so meditation is this sort of internal training of how we relate to what arises both psychologically and emotionally and physically in the body. Some people have this great misunderstanding that meditation means stopping your thoughts or stopping your mind. But this is not what the Buddha was teaching. The Buddha was teaching to observe your mind, to know what's happening as it's happening, and to be able to choose what the wise response to this mental, physical, or emotional experience is. So meditation is probably more psychological than it is spiritual. It's more of an internal mind training and a heart training than it is any kind of mystical experience. Through the repetition of bringing attention back to the present moment over and over and over, we see clearly what's happening, what's causing suffering, and then we have the free will to respond with the antidotes which will end suffering. To see the clinging and the aversion and the craving, and then to start to respond with compassion, forgiveness, non-attachment, and appreciation. Crazy, 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 crazy. I saw that I was a fucking dead. I saw that I was a fucking dead.
you're saying meditation and mindfulness frees you from suffering, right?
Yes.
What's wrong with suffering? Why don't you want to suffer?
It's a good question. Yeah. I don't want to suffer because why don't I want to suffer? I suffered a lot in my early life, and it just hurt all the time. Not only did it hurt me, but my suffering hurt a lot of other people. So I got to admit that mostly I don't want to suffer for myself. But as I have stopped suffering, I've also seen how not suffering so much has been so beneficial to my family. Because when we suffer, we don't only hurt ourselves, we hurt those around us with our suffering. It spills out of us. Some of us more than others, but certainly my suffering spilt out onto just about everyone who came into contact with me for a while there. And so not suffering is actually, I'm happier in myself and I enjoy that, but also it's an altruistic act of kindness and generosity to the world. Creates a positive change. Karmic reverberations, perhaps. Maybe there's nothing wrong with suffering if you're really choosing it. What I think is that actually we're born into a mind and body that naturally creates suffering, and that on one level there's nothing wrong with it, but that there is an option. Buddhism is for those who want to take the option and say, I want to not suffer so much. It's for those who are dissatisfied with the suffering in their life. If you're satisfied, no judgment, enjoy it. Yeah, really a pleasure to speak with you this evening. I would like to say, you know, if I've said anything that didn't sit right with you, I encourage you to meditate for 10 years and then trust yourself more than anything that I've said. But remember that the untrained mind is not necessarily so trustworthy. That when we train our minds, it becomes an ally and becomes trustworthy. But our sort of conditioned opinions, our minds, not really giving you the best advice most of the time, probably. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I love the Buddha's empowerment and encouragement to not trust him or Buddhism, but to trust your own direct experience most deeply. Not to have faith externally, but to know that everything that we are looking for is inside of us, and that we can find it through our own actions, our own introspection, mindfulness. But if I've said anything that has offended you, please forgive me. Really a pleasure to be here. And
thank you.
En tot zover deze uitzending van de Boeddhistische Omroep, die werd samengesteld door Menno Bijleveld. Presentatie en eindredactie Ton Maas, techniek Boris Nieuwenhuizen en Rob Gerritsen. Als u een van onze uitzendingen heeft gemist of meer wilt weten over onze programma's, kijk dan op boeddhistischeomroep.nl. Daar kunt u ook op deze uitzending reageren of met andere luisteraars van gedachten wisselen. Ons telefoonnummer is 035 677 1611. Ook op Facebook kunt u ons vinden onder BosRTV. Aanstaande zaterdag in de Zevende Hemel, Geen Meester, Geen Leerling. Een bundel dialogen tussen Maarten Houtman en Nico Tiedeman. Verder Evelien Beumkes over Wat de wereld nodig heeft, het nieuwe boek van Thich Nhat Hanh. En een gesprek met King Zero, een Burmeese monnik die vanuit Thailand verzet blijft voeren tegen de dictatuur in zijn land. Dat alles zaterdagmiddag om 3:00 in de Zevende Hemel op Radio 5. Graag tot dan.